Coming up, private genetic testing for a fee. Do you really want to know the diseases you're at risk for someday?
To be honest, in my initial reflection when I looked at this, I went, whoa.
And Father Leo, a priest who's also a chef, he says food is a natural part of his ministry.
Theologically, this is what Jesus did. Most of his greatest lessons were taught around a dinner table.
Plus, as September 11th approaches, a green light for the memorial to those who died on United Flight 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're YourRetirementCompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us as we begin our 13th season on the air. As September 11th approaches, President Barack Obama proclaimed this weekend National Days of Prayer and Remembrance in honor of the victims of the attacks. And he asked all Americans to mark September 11th with service to others. As part of the initiative, the president had called on religious and community groups to do special acts of charity in the week leading up to Labor Day. In Washington, D.C., several faith groups combined the Islamic observance of Ramadan with their service project. They gathered at an historic synagogue for an interfaith iftar, the traditional meal with which Muslims end their Ramadan daily fast. Meanwhile, the president hosted his own interfaith iftar at the White House. American Muslim leaders and representatives from Islamic nations attended. During the event, Obama honored the contributions of Muslims to American society. He also renewed his call for better relations between the U.S. and the Islamic world. Federal officials have ruled in favor of 100 Muslim workers who walked off their jobs during Ramadan last year. The employees on the evening shift at the JBS Swift meatpacking plant in Greeley, Colorado, wanted their lunch break to coincide with sunset so they could pray and end their day's fasting. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission said Swift failed to accommodate the workers and fired those who complained. The EEOC ruling could lead to a lawsuit if the company and its former employees can't reach a settlement. There were several developments this week regarding same-sex marriage. On September 1st, same-sex couples began getting married in Vermont. Earlier this year, Vermont became the fifth state to legalize gay marriage, and the only state so far that has done so through legislation and not a court ruling. Also this week, election officials in Maine announced that same-sex marriage will be on the November ballot. A law legalizing gay marriage was supposed to take effect this month, but opponents gathered enough signatures to force a referendum. And in Washington, D.C., the Roman Catholic Archdiocese is joining evangelical Protestants to mobilize opposition to same-sex marriage there. The District of Columbia City Council recently voted to recognize same-sex marriages performed elsewhere, and legislation to legalize gay marriage is expected to be introduced this fall. We have a special report today on a new service you may or may not want to buy. It's personalized genetic testing for a fee that tells you the diseases you may be at risk for in years to come. Are the findings accurate? Can they really be kept private? If you get bad news, how should you live? Saul Gonzalez reports from Los Angeles.
Unlocking and interpreting the secrets hidden in DNA used to be the province of scientists and medical researchers. But now it's a growing business, one that's selling genetic information directly to American consumers, making a DNA test as easy to buy as housewares or clothing.
You know, I think for the history of man, people have always wanted to see something about their future. And now, through the power of genetics and genomics, we're able to look into the future in a science-based way. But
Jack Lord is the CEO of Navigenics. It's a California-based company that, for a fee of $999, offers its clients a personalized DNA test, one that pinpoints genetic markers indicating possible future threats to their health.
It's really simple. It's just some saliva that we collect. We analyze that and then give you a report that shows what your risks are compared to people in the population at large. So today we test for 28 conditions, and they range from chronic conditions like diabetes or heart disease to cancers like melanoma or prostate cancer or breast cancer to other conditions that are generally silent disease like glaucoma, macular degeneration, celiac disease, to Alzheimer's disease.
Navigenics is one of a growing number of new companies selling genetic tests directly to the public. All of them promise their clients better health and a better life by getting up close and personal with their DNA.
Once you log into the Navigenics site, you get a snapshot page here that just really outlines in these square boxes, what you're at a high risk for, what you're at an average risk for, and what you're at a lower than average risk for.
Mike Godfrey, who works in corporate communications for a hospital in San Diego, is a Navigenics client. When he first got his DNA results back, Godfrey was surprised by his relative risk for several illnesses when compared to the rest of the population.
Diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, heart attack, brain aneurysm.
Atrial fibrillation, obesity.
Obesity. That's a would seem to be a lot to be worried about.
Graves' disease, which I never even heard of before. And so, to be honest, in my initial reflection when I looked at this, I went, whoa.
Four more, that's all you need.
Although he says he's not overly concerned, Godfrey's DNA test results have spurred him to think more about his health and spend a lot more time at the gym.
When you look through all those orange boxes that we went through and you take a look, almost all of them say that you should, keep your weight down, that you should stay in shape, that you should eat better. It was validation to me that, yeah, that was the right move. Your money's being spent in the right place. The work that you're going through is going to be worth it in the end.
Lord says his company offers tests only for treatable or preventable illnesses, giving clients an edge in anticipating and avoiding future health problems.
And it's with that information that they can start to understand what they might do today to prevent an illness. If you know that in advance, you can start going to your doctor more frequently to be checked, or you might start a medication that prevents that condition much earlier than when you become symptomatic.
It doesn't say you're going to die, here's why. It says here are some things that you're prone to, and here's how you can prevent them from showing up in your body later.
Sarah Crosby Helms, another Navigenics client, discovered through her test that she had a higher than usual genetic risk for both colon cancer and Crohn's disease. The information got Crosby thinking about how much she really wanted to know about future threats to her health.
For me, I would rather know that I have this genetic predisposition than to not know. And if that means that...
Ignorance isn't bliss.
No, ignorance for me is not bliss.
The direct-to-consumer genetics testing industry says it promises its clients a glimpse over their healthcare horizon, warning them of possible dangers and threats to come. But critics aren't so sure. They worry that the technology is being oversold and that it raises a host of both ethical and public policy concerns.
We don't know everything about the relationship between genes and diseases, and even what we do know doesn't really tell you that much about what should you do now.
Alexander Capron is a professor of law and medicine at the University of Southern California and the former director of the ethics program at the World Health Organization. He's concerned that as genetic tests become more common, a growing number of people will overemphasize DNA as the road to a long life and personal happiness.
There are so many other things that are equally or more important and that are actually things that we should be more concerned about in our environment, in our human relations, in social justice, so that all people have an opportunity to have a life in which they can flourish and so forth, and not just narrowly, well, what's your genetic code? I would also be aware that you could have some surprises that you really don't want to know, that you just as soon not have on your mind. What should you do now? What difference should this make in the way you behave, in the health care you get, in your relationships with loved ones, your plans for your future? Should you not take a certain job because the payoff in that job won't come for 10 or 20 years and you've got a gene that says you have a 20% chance of getting breast cancer or something? And just what should you do with that information?
There are also concerns among some health experts about the regulation of direct-to-consumer DNA testing. Currently, no federal agency, such as the Food and Drug Administration or Federal Trade Commission, has come up with rules to monitor the company's marketing claims, testing practices, or the validity of results.
I think we're still in early days on the regulation side, and the FDA has more work to do here. The field has grown, I think, faster than anyone expected.
Worried about the licensing, utility, and accuracy of direct-to-consumer genetic tests, some states, such as California and New York, have sent cease and desist letters to prominent DNA testing companies. Then there are the privacy worries and whether someone's genetic information could leak out to insurance companies or employers. Lord acknowledges protecting genetic data is crucial to his company's reputation and future.
Privacy is to Navigenics like safety is to Volvo. We have to have, our brand is dependent on privacy and the integrity of privacy and security. And the visual that we use is, imagine walking into a bank vault. And inside that bank vault, there are safe deposit boxes. And the only way you open that safe deposit box is if you have a key and the bank has a key. And that's the way we've built all of our systems. You have control of how that information is accessed, what it's accessed for, and who it actually has accessed.
You've just shared a great deal of your genetic information with us. Do you have any privacy concerns sharing it with us and, by extension, an audience across the country?
Obviously, I don't.
Mike Godfrey's confidence comes partially from the Genetic Non-Discrimination Privacy Act passed by Congress in 2008. It prohibits health insurers from denying coverage based solely on a person's genetic predisposition.
My feeling is that those laws will continue to be updated and that there won't be much risk to me in the future or to anybody who does this. I think that this will actually become a pretty standard approach as you go into the future for adults and maybe even for children when they're very young.
As he uses his genetic results to guide his health decisions, Godfrey is also a test subject. He's one of thousands of Navigenics clients who have volunteered to be monitored for the next 20 years as part of a scientific study. Its purpose? To find out how and if people change their lifestyles after finding out what's in their DNA.
Bring it all the way up.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles.
In other news, changes are ahead for the world's best-selling translation of the Bible, the New International Version, or NIV. The team behind the NIV announced it will be making revisions to reflect changes in the English language and advances in biblical scholarship. The process is likely to reignite contentious debates over how gender-neutral the NIV should be. 5 years ago, controversy surrounded another updated translation called Today's NIV. The team doing this revision says about 90% of the NIV will remain the same and that most changes will have nothing to do with gender inclusivity. The NIV was first published in 1978. It's the best-selling Bible of all translations, well ahead of the King James Version. There are more than 300 million copies of the NIV in print. The Dalai Lama made a high-profile visit to Taiwan this week to offer comfort in the wake of last month's deadly typhoon. The Buddhist leader toured the ravaged countryside and held several prayer services for the victims. Some 670 people were killed in the worst typhoon to hit Taiwan in over 50 years. China voiced opposition to the Dalai Lama's visit, which it said could harm relations between the mainland and Taiwan. Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley is defending his participation in Senator Edward Kennedy's funeral mass last week. Catholic conservatives from around the nation have been criticizing the cardinal, saying Kennedy did not merit a Catholic funeral because of his stance on abortion. However, on his blog, O'Malley said he considered it appropriate to represent the church at the event out of respect for the senator, his family, and those who were praying for the Kennedy family at that difficult time. Now, a profile of Father Leo Potalinghug, an unusual and entertaining Catholic priest who has turned his hobby of cooking into a ministry. Father Leo has a cooking show online, he's written a cookbook, and he's gaining international attention with his popular recipe of food, spirituality, and laughter. Kim Lawton has more.
Entregado por vosotros.
Roman Catholic priests deal a lot with spiritual food, but Father Leo Potalinghug works with food of a more earthly nature as well.
And I've gotten myself here a nice, beautiful piece of flank steak.
Father Leo is a chef who has his own web-based cooking show called Grace Before Meals. It gets more than 10,000 hits a day from around the world. He's written a cookbook with the same title.
We ask God to bless us this holy season and the food we're about to receive.
He says food is very much part of his priestly ministry.
Theologically, this is what Jesus did. Most of his greatest lessons were taught around a dinner table.
In his day job, Father Leo is director of pastoral field education at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland, the second oldest and second largest Catholic seminary in the country.
Sometimes I like to say I am teaching future shepherds how to feed their hungry flock.
He teaches classes on a variety of subjects, such as how to give a good sermon. And even here, he finds a connection with food.
I teach a preaching class, which means I can't have guys dishing out stale, boring leftovers, but dynamic things that are going to make their appetites just expand and to whet their appetites to show that what we have to offer is good news.
Father Leo says his mother taught him how to cook when he was a kid.
My love for cooking started just because I like to eat. And
I love that sound.
After doing my activities, I would get bored quickly. Mother would invite me to help her with cooking because it's a multitasking thing, and that actually piqued my interest.
Father Leo grew up in Baltimore, where his family had emigrated from the Philippines. He says faith and food were both very important in his family's life.
My family's style of eating is very much a feast day celebration, and yes, we prayed before every meal, and it was something very serious because in my country, not everyone gets a chance to eat. And so they reminded us that even though we were living in America, a land of plenty, there are a lot of people who don't have the blessings on the table as well as the blessings around the table.
He didn't always know he would become a priest. He first dabbled in several other fields, from breakdancing to martial arts.
I used to be a martial artist. Still practice a little bit of it. Third-degree black belt instructor in Taekwondo, as well as a full-contact Filipino martial art called Arnis. So if you ask what I did for fun before I became a priest, I used to beat people up with sticks. That's what I did.
In the midst of it all, he says a series of events, including a skiing accident and a breakup with his girlfriend, had him turning to God in prayer. Then he says he traveled to the Philippines with the U.S. stick fighting team.
I remember going to this one village, and we were handing out candy to people. And there was one little boy who only had a T-shirt on, and he came up to me, and I gave him a piece of candy. And I looked in his eyes, and I thought to myself, had it not been for my dad bringing us to America, that could be me.
He felt that God was calling him to help people like that boy, and to do so by becoming a priest. He entered seminary and was ordained 10 years ago when he was 29. Father Leo says the food part of the ministry evolved naturally as he began building relationships with his parishioners. He often scheduled counseling sessions around mealtimes.
They call me Father. I'm supposed to be part of their family. And so I would help them. We would gather in the kitchen. We would help cook. I'd help set up the table. And they saw the human side to me and not just the spiritual side.
Bless his food. And
the idea for a cooking show was born just after the attacks on September 11th, 2001.
So after a very tragic weekend worth of masses where the churches were full, hungering for inspiration of hope, we ourselves, the ministers, We were spent, so we went on a little retreat together, and I did all the cooking, comfort food. So one of the priests suggested, I love watching you cook. It would be great if I had a video camera and just taped all of this, and you could talk about food, faith, family, and culture. And I looked at him and I said, that's one of the dumbest ideas I have ever heard.
But his fellow priest didn't think it was so dumb. Father Leo says they kept nagging him about it and eventually connected him with a producer and a production company who loved the idea of a priest cooking show.
You see that slob right there? That's what confession is for.
He now does webisodes of the cooking show online, often with the help of his seminarians, and his website has recipes and blogs.
Cleanliness is next to, you know what I mean.
He's also become a much sought-after speaker, and he does cooking demonstrations around the country, such as this appearance at the Delaware State Fair.
This beef is going to, oh my gosh, it's making me pray already.
His motto is feeding people mind, body, and soul. And he believes that families are strengthened when they share meals together.
We know that families are buying so much into the fast food mentality that they spend no time with each other. My objective with Grace Before Meals is to create many Thanksgivings throughout the year.
When he speaks to a secular audience, he tries not to be aggressively religious.
We all are hungering for something. And that's why people go everywhere, to find something to satisfy them. And what I'd like to invite you to consider is to make sure you have a balanced diet for your body, your mind, and your soul.
I loved how he brought the spirituality into, you know, the mealtime and the family. I think that's probably what drew everybody's attention. And the food was delicious.
He's gaining international attention and was just challenged to a cooking competition by celebrity chef Bobby Flay. I asked him how he keeps it all from going to his head.
I guess the celebrity status could be a temptation for anyone, but as a priest, I'm somewhat protected in this. I'm required to spend time in quiet prayer and reflection. A holy hour a day gives me a great perspective. I'm just me doing something good for God.
Father Leo does get criticism from some Catholics who think it's inappropriate for a priest to be doing what he does. But he asserts that his food ministry is deeply Christian.
We believe, at least in the Catholic Church, what binds us together and what binds God to us is food, a piece of bread turned into the body and blood of Christ, in which we are incorporated into his family.
So I got to tell you, I know that the collar freaks people out a little bit.
Father Leo says for him, one of the most important parts of his cooking ministry is reaching out to people who may be uncomfortable with priests and helping them learn a little about God.
He can take a breakdancing, board-breaking, bread-breaking priest and, you know, give hope to people who might not understand the church or might understand a priest.
And that, he says, is a grace that extends beyond every meal. I'm Kim Lawton in Emmitsburg, Maryland.
Finally, ever since 9/11, there have been plans and negotiations for a memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, to the 40 passengers and crew members who died when United Airlines Flight 93 crashed. When hijackers diverted their plane, passengers struggled to take control. Their bravery prevented the hijackers from continuing to their apparent target, Washington, D.C. This week, the Interior Department announced agreement with the last property owners at the crash site. Groundbreaking for the memorial is scheduled for November 7th. A year after 9/11, Kim Lawton interviewed an expert on sacred spaces about the Shanksville Memorial. He is Edward Linenthal, a professor of history at Indiana University.
For me personally, Shanksville is an incredibly eloquent place, maybe because I was unprepared for the power of that grove of trees where the debris field was. Memorial issues are almost by definition razor's edge issues. What do we mean when we call a place sacred ground? What happens to a site when 92% of the human remains that were on that plane will never be recovered? How do you deal with that? Do you open that site to the public? Should people other than family members be allowed to walk in the area where there will always be human remains? when I went to the site, it was this beautiful grove of trees that was quiet and compelling, and the wind was blowing through the trees, and the natural beauty of the site was such a contrast with the horror that had happened there.
The approved design for the memorial would create a bowl-shaped space near the crash site with 40 groves of red maple trees. There would be a walkway around the edge of the site, but not through it. Professor Linenthal thinks the designers have succeeded in creating a plan that is modest, that fits the location, and that respects the site as both a public memorial and a grave. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We have much more on our website, including more of Kim Lawton's interview with Father Leo and a link to some of his recipes. You can also comment on our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are available as well. Join us at pbs.org.